Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering Joshua chapter 8, the entire chapter verse. Well, actually, not the entire chapter, verses 1 through 29, the first part of the chapter. And we will, in this portion of Scripture, read about the fall of Ai, the second city defeated by the Israelites after Jericho. Our last chapter, the context is Joshua 7. We saw Israel defeated by Ai and the Israelites' hearts melted with fear. They were defeated, of course, because of the sin of Achan, who had covered over booty that was supposed to be chrem, devoted to God, and he stole some of it, got executed, and that's what happened in the last chapter. So now we're going to see how God's going to turn the situation around. The sin has been removed from the camp, and now the sanctified army of Israel is going to whop Ai. So we start now in Joshua 8, verses 1 and 2. Now the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear or be dismayed. Take all the people of war with you and arise. Go up to Ai. See, I have given into your hand the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. You shall do to Ai and its king just as you did to Jericho and its king. You shall take only its spoil and its cattle as plunder for yourselves. Set an ambush for the city behind it." Now, why was the Lord saying to Joshua, don't fear? Well, because of the defeat of Ai, recorded in the previous chapter 7, because of the sin of Achan. Matthew Henry says, treacherous Israelites are to be dreaded more than malicious Canaanites. Well, at any rate, as I said, the Israelites' hearts were melted with fear, and God's trying to buck up Joshua. I imagine he was pretty scared. He says, take all the people of war with you. Now, this introduces a big issue, controversy. I know it's not a big controversy, it's a small controversy, actually, between the commentators as to how many warriors did Joshua take with him in order to conquer Ai. Well, here are our options. 500,000. This is Gill and Benson, of course. I don't know why 500,000. Some people say 600,000. So let's just say a whole heap of, at least a half a million. And that would include the 40,000 from the 2.5 tribes east of Jordan. They volunteered their services, of course, as we know. Now, why so many people? After all, there's only 12,000 people in Ai. Why do you need 500,000 people to go take Ai? Well, for the people who hold to this option, people such as John Gill and the commentator Benson, whose first name I don't know, here are some reasons why that 500,000 people could have been taken, 500,000 soldiers could have been taken by Joshua. The pulpit commentator says it was to encourage Joshua. Hey, you got all these soldiers behind, we're going to whip up on Ai. The commentator Benson says the reason that Joshua took so many soldiers was to strike fear into Ai. The fear that had been occasioned by the fall of Jericho now has dissipated. And now the Israelites don't look so unconquerable, and it doesn't look like Yahweh is at their fore. So the people of Ai need to see 500,000, 600,000 troops getting ready to whop them. Another option is to show that all the soldiers were going to get a share of the plunder. In other words, Joshua was saying, look here, guys, I'm not going to just let 30,000 soldiers get plunder. I'm going to let all the fighting men of Israel get plunder, and so I'm going to let you go. And that would be an incentive for future conquest of Canaan. 500,000 soldiers would dispel the people's misgivings about the previous failure at Ai in chapter 7. Matthew Henry suggests that the 500 or 600,000 soldiers sent were a tacit rebuke to Joshua. In other words, God didn't like it that so few were sent before. Joshua, how could you be so stupid as just to send 3,000 people up against Ai? Why should you have been so stupid as to deprive most of the soldiers a chance for plunder? So, hey, this time send 500,000 or 600,000. Well, all that's very nice. All these reasons why Joshua sent 500,000. But there's a problem with that, is because 30,000 are mentioned in a later verse, verse 3. So Joshua rose with all the people of war to go up to Ai, and Joshua chose 30,000 men. So now we've got to reconcile this 500 or 600,000 that was sent with this 30,000 that are mentioned in verse 3. So there's your problem. Well, how do you deal with that? The people who say that 500,000 or 600,000 troops were sent say that the 30,000 were placed in a separate place, not mentioned where. I don't read the text. I don't see where they were put. And then 5,000 of these were placed in the ambush in the rear. So somehow these 30,000 sort of float separate from the other two. I don't believe that, quite frankly. Let me read you what Adam Clark says about this. From the letter of this verse, it appears that all that were capable of carrying arms were to march out of the camp. Because the word all is actually used there. It says all the men of war. 30,000 chosen men formed an ambuscade in one place, 5,000 be placed in another. In other words, there's two ambushes that are set up. One of 30,000 and one of 5,000, who had all gained their positions in the night season with the rest of the army. He appeared the next morning before Ai, which the men of the city would naturally suppose were the whole of the Israelitish forces, and consequently be the more emboldened to come out and attack them. But some think that 30,000 men were the whole that were employed on this occasion, 5,000 of whom were placed as an ambuscade on the west side of the city between Bethel and Ai. And with the rest, he appeared before the city in the morning. And that's what I think. The king of Ai, seeing but about 25,000 coming against him and being determined to defend the city and crown to the last extremity, though he had but 12,000 persons in the whole city, scarcely one half of whom we can suppose to be effective men, he was determined to risk a battle and accordingly issued out and was defeated by the stratagem mentioned in the preceding part of this chapter. Several eminent commentators are of opinion that the whole Israelitish force was employed on this occasion, because what is said in the first verse, and what is said in the first verse is, it says all the men of war went out. But, says Clark, this is not at all likely. One, it appears that but 30,000 were chosen out of the whole camp for this expedition. That's in verse 3. The rest being drawn up in readiness should their cooperation be necessary. All right, so now let me give you some arguments in favor of the Adam Clark position that only 30,000 were sent, not 500 or 600,000. Argument number one, it would have been absurd to use several hundred thousand soldiers against 12,000 inhabitants. And by the way, that's not 12,000 soldiers, because half of those were women and children. And after all, in Joshua 7 verse 3, we see that the spies originally thought that 3,000 would be enough. Joshua sent out spies to scope out Ai. They came back, 30,000, we can take this place. So you're going to send 500 or 600,000 troops against Ai? Argument number two, in favor of 30,000 rather than 500 or 600,000. If Joshua had advanced with 500,000 troops, the ambush never would have worked. The men of Ai would not have been enticed to leave the city and chase Joshua. When Joshua used his feigned withdrawal, a very common tactic in ancient warfare, so 500,000 people retreat, you think that roughly 6,000 soldiers are going to chase 500,000? No, it was only 30,000 that went out, in my humble opinion. Now, I still have to deal with verse 2, which says that all the people of war went out. The Holman Christian Study Bible says the whole military force went out. Young's literal translation says all the people of war went out. Well, that all is a slippery word. It can mean all exhaustively, every last single one. Or it can just mean a lot, many. And in my opinion, that's what it means here. Take many of the people of war. Take a lot, you know, 30,000 is a lot against 6,000 soldiers, but it's not 500,000. So I don't think that word all disposes of the problem. All right, I've spent too much time on this little, it doesn't really matter. The point is that Joshua is to go up to Ai, up, of course, because Ai is in a mountain. If you look at the map, which I have in front of me here, Jerusalem, you go about 10 miles north of Jerusalem, there's a spinal ridge of mountains. It looks like a spine. It runs right up the middle of Israel from Jerusalem right on up into Bethel. And just a couple of miles to the east of Bethel is Ai. And Joshua and troops are on the plain of Jordan near Jericho. They've just taken Jericho. And that's right down there near the Jordan River, where it's flat. So they're supposed to go up to Ai. See, I've given into your hand the king of Ai, God says, his people, his city, and his land. Now, how many people were there? I've already said there was 12,000 men and women in Ai. We know that from Joshua 8:25. In this chapter, verse 25, the total of those who fell that day, both men and women, was 12,000, both men and women. That's how we know that there was less than 12,000 soldiers, because it's men and women that were taken at the end of the battle. Now in verse 2, Joshua is told, you shall do to Ai and its king just as you did to Jericho and its king. Well, how did Joshua deal with Jericho and its king, burnt the city down, killed the king. Joshua 6:21, talking about Jericho. They completely destroyed everything in the city with a sword. Every man and woman, both young and old, every ox, sheep, and donkey. Now, things weren't exactly the same with Ai because the soldiers were allowed to keep the animals, the ox, the sheep, and the donkeys. Not so with Jericho. They were not allowed to take the soldiers or the women or the children as slaves. They were to be executed. Notice the word only. In verse 2, you shall take only its spoil and its cattle as plunder. What that means is you get the cattle and the gold and the silver, but you don't get the people. You don't get to take slaves. They're supposed to be executed. Now, I asked myself the question, why are the Israelites allowed to plunder Ai? They weren't allowed to plunder Jericho. Now, I looked at a whole ton of commentaries, and naturally when I have a question, it happens so often that the commentaries don't even think about it, either because they know more than I do and think it's obvious, or because they just didn't think about it. I don't know. So I've been going to come up with some options of my own why the distinction between Jericho and Ai. First possible reason is that the spoils of Jericho were the first fruits of the plunder taken by the Israelites in Canaan. The first fruits are given to God, and that's already been done. God's got his first fruits, and so now the soldiers got the rest. They needed booty for Israel to live on. They had planted no crops, remember. They were probably carrying with them sheep and goats and cattle from the eastern side of the Jordan River, which they had liberated from their previous Amorite owners. But they still needed stuff. And they also needed a little encouragement, too. Hey, if I go in there and risk my neck, I'll get some booty. So I assume that's why there's a difference now between Ai and Jericho with regard to the question of plunder. Now, as I said earlier, the fighting men were killed. Joshua 11:14 says this, the Israelites plundered all the spoils and cattle of these cities for themselves, but they struck down every person with a sword until they had annihilated them, leaving no one alive. This refers to Joshua's conquest of the northern cities. Now, I probably ought to mention here, because this always comes up, oh, my God, it's so unjust. How can you kill the men and the women and the children? Listen, these people were committing idolatry. They were worshiping demons. They were sacrificing their children to idols. The book of Leviticus says you're not supposed to do all these things like the nations around you are doing. And then Leviticus mentions homosexuality, bestiality, wonderful stuff like that. And God had already told Abraham in the famous Genesis 15 chapter, he said, your descendants are going to be carried down to another country where they'll be slaves. And then 400 years, they're going to come back and wipe out the Amorites, which stands for all the Canaanite tribes of Israel, wipe them out because the cup of the Amorites has not been filled yet. In other words, this was God's judicial judgment upon people who had really gotten depraved. They got what they deserved. So don't start feeling sorry. You know, when you think of the women and children, you think of nice, sweet little innocent women, and the children are cherub-cheeked. They got little halos over their head. You ever seen the videos of children being raised in Iraq being trained to hate Jews and to kill people? How about in Africa when these little kids are trained to fight and kill? Like, what's the name of that famous movie about the diamond mines down there? I can't remember. But children can get to be pretty nasty too. Ever see Lord of the Flies? Those were all children doing that stuff, that nasty, horrible stuff. Referring to the depravity of human beings, and that includes kids. So, you know, and as John Piper, I just read an article by John Piper on this. He said, look, God gives life and he takes life. He can destroy. He created life. He can take it away anytime he wants. He did it with Noah's flood, killed every man, woman, and child on the planet, except, of course, for the 8 that survived. So who are we to point our finger at God's? And Piper pointed out that what makes it a little bit more morally complex is that when God does it, that's one thing. But then when he tells people to do it, it's another. Well, God uses natural means. He could have wiped out the Canaanites with a plague or something like that, but he chose to use Joshua and the armies of Israel. Joshua was the head of a kingdom. That's the way kingdoms fought back then. It would have happened to Israel if they'd have gotten beat. Their men and women and children would have gotten killed too. They had no way to handle POWs back then. But anyway, that's an old apologetic chestnut. I'm not going to spend any more time than I have on that. But now there's another interesting thing that a lot of commentators have spent a whole lot of question on, which is a total waste of time. Should Joshua have sunk to such a horrible moral low as to ambush the people of AI? John Gill mentions that some have called into question the legality of that. I think it was John Calvin said this was absurd. No, it was a pulpit commentary I read said it's absurd to even talk about this. So they weren't going to talk about it. I probably should do the same thing. But listen, every army uses stratagems and feints. Nobody accuses the general of being immoral for doing that. Joshua had to use some kind of strategy. He had no siege engines to assault the city. A blockade would have taken so long that other Canaanites, kings, and their troops would have come and attacked Israel as they were besieging Ai. He had no choice. And this shows, by the way, this use of the ambush, that God uses both natural means, an ambush, and supernatural means, the fall of the walls of Jericho, both. He used whatever means he wants to. And you know, people getting so upset about wiping out the Canaanites. I mean, America wiped out two cities with atom bombs. And of course, some people do question the morality of that, but most don't. Because if they hadn't have done it, the estimate that was given President Truman at the time was, I think, at least a million, several million, I forgot the numbers, a huge number of Allied troops, most of them Americans, would have been killed by these crazy Japanese who were killing everybody. So, you know, most people don't feel too sorry about that, but no, a lot of people are going to blame God when he wipes out people who deserve it. And I'll tell you one thing. America is getting close to the point where we deserve it. We're not quite as depraved as those Canaanites, but we are fast getting there. And, of course, this does not give anybody sanction to go out and commit genocide, any natural government. It was at the command of God. It was limited. They could only wipe out certain cities at certain times to take the men and the women of children, the men and the women, excuse me, the only at certain times could they take the women and children. So it was constrained. And plus, it was a political, military organization. Old Testament Israel was. The New Testament is not that. It's a spiritual kingdom. We have no right to use the sword on anybody for any reason. Not for conversion like Clovis and Charlemagne. No, we have no right to do that. Only secular governments have the right to do that. And the duty to do that, actually. Because if evil is not checked, civilization and human life collapses. Look at the state of California. Can't even go into a Walgreens before the place is half shoplifted because the morons that run the city and run the state of California refuse to enforce any kind of law, any kind of order, any kind of legal discipline. And as a result, the place is turning into anarchy and everybody wants to get out. Now in verse 2, God tells Joshua to set an ambush for the city behind the city, and that would be to the west of the city. The 30,000 troops that he's going to take are going to end up at the north of the city. We go down to Joshua 8, verses 3 through 9. So Joshua rose with all the people of war to go up to Ai, and Joshua chose 30,000 men, valiant warriors, and sent them out at night. He commanded them, saying, "See, you are going to ambush the city from behind it." That's to the west. "Do not go very far." And the reason he says "you," I'm assuming that he's talking about the 5,000 who are going to come out of the 30,000 going to go to the west of the city, and the other 25,000 are going to be at the north of the city. "Do not go very far from the city, but all of you be ready. Then I and all the people who are with me will approach the city." That would be the 25,000 that are left. "And when they come out to meet us as at the first, we will flee before them. They will come out after us until we have drawn them away from the city, for they will say they are fleeing before us as at the first." That means the previous disaster when the 3,000 Israelites were sent out and they ran. "So we will flee before them, and you shall rise from your ambush and take possession of the city, for the Lord your God will deliver it into your hand. Then it will be when you have seized the city that you shall set the city on fire. You shall do it according to the word of the Lord. See, I have commanded you." So Joshua sent them away, and they went to the place of ambush and remained between Bethel and Ai. Bethel was about 2 miles or so to the north and west of Ai. So that's where the ambush was. And we're all talking about 10 miles or so north of Jerusalem. So the ambush stayed on the west side of Ai, but Joshua spent that night among the people, which, as we'll see later, was on the north of the city on a hill. Now, verse 7, "The ambush shall rise and take possession of the city." We'll find out later, a few verses later in this chapter, verses 18 and 19, "The ambush will rise when they see Joshua hold up a javelin. Then the Lord said to Joshua, 'Stretch out the javelin that is in your hand toward Ai, for I will give it into your hand.' So Joshua stretched out the javelin. The men in ambush rose quickly from their place. They went and ran into the city and captured it. So that's how this is going to be set up. This, by the way, is a common tactic in ancient warfare. If I remember my facts correctly, when William the Conqueror was trying to invade the southern coast of England at the famous Battle of Hastings in 1066 AD, the Normans, under William's control, retreated from his left flank, and Harold's men, King Harold of the Anglo-Saxons in England, King Harold's men on their right flank chased William the Conqueror's men. And William the Conqueror looked up and says, they're out of position. And so then he went and wiped them out, and the rest was history. And England is now a Norman country instead of a Anglo-Saxon country. Now, that might not have been on purpose. I don't remember the details. That might have just been William's army broke at the unfortunate time, and the Anglo-Saxons under Harold were not disciplined enough to stay put. But at any rate, this is a common thing, fake ambushes. You read about it all the time. Verse 8, God tells Joshua, "You shall do it according to the word of the Lord. See, I have commanded you." That gives you a lot of confidence when you know you have a word of God to do something that's difficult. Now in verse 8, God tells Joshua to set the city on fire. And that would probably be the ambushers from the north would set the city on fire. Now, Gill and Clark say something interesting. They say that the city was not to be burnt completely down, because then if the city was totally destroyed, there wouldn't be any chance for the soldiers to plunder the city for spoil. So Gill and Clark say that the ambushers were only to burn some outlying houses, which of course would then keep the AI troops from retreating back from their unfortunate chase of the deceiving, retreating Israelites. They couldn't get back into their city because the outskirts were on fire. So Joshua spends the night, and now in verses 10 through 13, we see what happens the next morning. Now Joshua rose early in the morning and mustered the people, and he went up with the elders of Israel before the people to Ai. I hope I didn't say that Joshua spent the night north of Ai. He didn't. He spent the night in his camp down there at Jericho. Then he rose up early in the morning, mustered the people, mustered the soldiers, and he went up with the elders of Israel before the people to Ai. So now he's at Ai. Then all the people of war who were with him went up and drew near and arrived in front of the city and camped on the north side of Ai. That's how we know he's on the north side. It states here in the text. Now there was a valley between him and Ai. So the valley is running east and west, and he's north, and Ai is to the south. And he took about 5,000 men and set them in ambush between Bethel and Ai on the west side of the city. So they stationed the people, all the army that was on the north side of the city, and its rear guard on the west side of the city. That's the ambushers. And Joshua spent that night in the midst of the valley. All right, so we now another day has passed. Joshua is arranging his troops. The whole day goes by. The ambush is set. Now, he doesn't spend the night with his 30,000 troops on the hill to the north of Ai. He goes down into the valley that separates his troops and Ai and spends the night there. Now, the question is why would he do that? Well, here's some options. He could have gone down into the valley to check to see if his sentinels were alert in case the Ai troops decided to make a surprise attack on the Israelites. He could have gone down there to pray and meditate, but I don't see why he couldn't pray and meditate up on the hill just as well as in the valley, so that's not a good option, really. Or it could be so that being down in the valley, the ambuscade, the 5,000 soldiers to the west of Ai, could easier see his raised javelin, because that was the sign when they were supposed to attack. That was the sign that told the ambushers that the fake retreat was going to stop and they need to come in, capture the city, so then the fake retreaters could turn around and help the 5,000 men take the city. Now, it says in verse 10 that Joshua mustered the people. King James has Joshua numbered the people. Adam Clark says Joshua, quote, inspected their ranks to see whether everything was in perfect readiness, that in case they should be needed, they might be led on to the attack. Now, of course, there's the dispute. Is this the 500, 600,000? Is this the 30,000? Or is it just the ambuscade of 5,000? I'm not going to get into that anymore. I'm assuming it's the 30,000 that went up on to the north side of Ai. The elders went with Joshua. Now, that, of course, could be the 70 elders, the famous 70 elders who all the way back at Mount Sinai were appointed to lead the whole nation of Israel. They were all tribes in Israel had tribal elders, but out of those tribal elders were chosen 70 other elders, kind of capital E elders, who were in charge of the whole nation, not just their own particular tribe. John Gill says it could be those elders, or it could be some inferior officers, military people. Well, we can speculate about that slippery word all we want, but the point is that we've got civil authorities, probably civil authorities, going up to AI. Why? Jameson Fawcett Brown says this, a presence and official authority were necessary to ensure that the cattle and spoil of the city might be equally divided between the combatants and the rest of the people. A military rule in Israel that would have been very liable to be infringed if an excited soldiery, eager for booty, had been left to their own will. That's some interesting speculation. Got to keep the troops under control. Now, the fact that the Israelite army was on a hill made the Israelites more visible to the men of Ai. So that means that the men of Ai were more likely to be suckered out to chase Israel because they could see him so well. We go now to Joshua 8, verses 14 through 17. It came about when the king of Ai saw it that the men of the city hurried and rose up early and went out to meet Israel in battle, he and all his people at the appointed place before the desert plain. But he did not know that there was an ambush against him behind the city. That's to the west. He's going north, and to the west, there's the ambush, 5,000 soldiers. Joshua and all Israel pretended to be beaten before them and fled by the way of the wilderness. And all the people who were in the city were called together to pursue them, and they pursued Joshua and were drawn away from the city. So not a man was left in Ai or Bethel who had not gone out after Israel, and they left the city unguarded and pursued Israel. Now this appointed place the NASB has that they fought, or where the king of Ai sent his troops out to meet Israel at an appointed place, the King James has time. Well, if that translation is accurate, and I don't think it probably is, but if it is, that means that it could be on the same day as the first successful sally against the Israelites that happened recently. The king of Ai may have been superstitious, as we beat them at 10:05 or 8:07 the day before, or the battle before, and so we're going to do it again. Or maybe it was an appointed time in which the men of Bethel and the men of Ai rendezvous, because we're going to see later in verse 17 that Bethel, perhaps, there's a manuscript problem here, but perhaps Bethel allied themselves with Ai, so maybe they went to that appointed at an appointed time, met the people of Bethel. But the NIV, the NASB, the Holman Christian Study Bible says it's an appointed place. Now, if that's the case, that means that the appointed place was appointed by God, not by Ai, because not by the king of Ai. He's not going to make a deal with Joshua where we're going to battle. Sometimes they did that in the Middle Ages in the time of chivalry, but this is not a chivalrous time here. So I'm assuming this is the appointed place, which means appointed by God. Before the desert plain, that's the valley I've been talking about between the main body of the Israelites on the north and Ai on the opposite hill on the south. Now the Israelites pretended to flee, and they fled by the way of the wilderness. There's some options as to what wilderness we're talking about. Could be the wilderness of Bethaven, which is actually given a name in Joshua 18. The wilderness of Bethaven is mentioned. Bethaven is a little place somewhere to the east of Bethel, most probably. There's a question mark on the BibleAtlas.org map. They don't know exactly where it is, but that's probably where it is. And if this map is correct, we got Bethel a couple miles to the northwest of Ai, and Bethaven a couple miles to the northeast of Ai. And so since the Israelites are to the north of Ai, that wilderness there, they could have just gone straight east right into the wilderness to sucker the soldiers of Ai out. Or, optionally, it could refer, the wilderness that they fled to could be the wilderness of Bethel and Ephraim, which is to the west. Some commentators suggested it could be near Jericho, wilderness of Ephraim near Jericho, or it could be a desert, the desert valley of the Jordan, which is where the Israelites were encamped before they sent their troops to Ai. It just makes more sense to say the wilderness of Bethaven is right near them. It's real it has to be close because they turn around and chase the people of Ai back into the city. So that's, in my opinion, is what wilderness is being talked about here. Verse 16 says, all the people who were in the city were called together to pursue the Israelites. Now, of course, the all means all fighting men, not the women and children. Let's say it's half, or say it's 6,000 soldiers. The king of Ai would probably think if he's going to beat 25,000, they're fleeing for whatever reason, but he's going to need 6,000 to wrap them up. And, of course, as I said earlier, it makes it highly unlikely that the Israelite soldiers would number 500 or 600,000, because 6,000 people aren't going to chase an army that big. All right, I mentioned earlier that Bethel might have been in league with Ai at this battle. If so, we have a problem. How did the men of Bethel get to Ai without discovering the ambush? Because remember, Bethel's to the northwest and the ambush is to the west of Ai, so they will be coming, the men of Bethel would be coming in the general direction of the ambush. Well, if you look at the map, they could easily take another road around the ambush and miss them. Could be the ambush purposely hid and let them pass. Adam Clark suggests that the men of Bethel had earlier been taken into Ai as allies. Here's his quote. It is very likely that the principal strength of Bethel had been previously brought into Ai as the strongest place to make a stand in, Bethel being but about 3 miles distance from Ai and probably not greatly fortified. Maybe so. I don't think that's a big problem. And not only that, the words Bethel are not in the Septuagint. Let me read what Jameson Fawcett and Brown said. It may be remarked, however, that the words, or Bethel, are not in the Septuagint and are rejected by some eminent scholars as an interpolation not found in the most ancient manuscripts. So we have a manuscript problem. So not a man was left in Ai or Bethel who had not gone out. Might should read, so not a man was left in Ai who had not gone out after Israel. So Bethel might not have been allied with the soldiers of Ai. Adam Clark has one more comment I thought I would mention. Quote, others think that the Bethelites, seeing the Israelites fly, sallied out of their city as against a common enemy. In other words, they hadn't really marched to the battle anywhere, either in the valley or in the city of Ai. They were just sitting in their own city. But then they see the Israelites fly, or some scout saw it. So they sallied out of their city at the same time as the Ai soldiers are doing that so that they can beat Israel. But the Bethelites, finding the men of Ai discomfited and the city taken, they returned to Bethel, which Joshua did not think proper to attack at this time. And I think that's probably pretty reasonable. That's good speculations about what happened. Now, one thing that helped Israel pull off this feint, this stratagem, to get the men of Ai to chase them, to pursue them, is they had already been beaten shortly before, if you recall, when their 3,000 soldiers had to run down the hill as the men of Ai chased them. And so they probably thought, well, we beat them once, we're going to beat them again. And so that's an example, Romans 8:28, God taking something bad and working it together for good. Now, Jameson Fawcett and Brown conclude from this that the king was foolish to do that, and I think he was. Here's what those commentators say, quote, it is evident that this king and his subjects were little experienced in war. Otherwise, they would have sent out scouts to reconnoiter the neighborhood. At all events, they would not have left their town wholly unprotected and open. Perhaps an ambuscade may have been a war stratagem hitherto unknown in that country and among that people. Well, I've read enough ancient history to know that even in countries and amongst military folks where everybody knows about ambushes, a lot of times the generals can't even control their own soldiers. The soldiers get so excited when they see the enemy retreating and they think, plunder, booty, and they run out of formation, run after them, leaving the flanks of the rest of the army totally unprotected, and then disaster strikes. So, yeah, he was foolish, but you can always say that about people that get defeated and killed and hung up. Joshua 8, verses 18 and 19. Then the Lord said to Joshua, stretch out the javelin that is in your hand toward Ai, for I will give it into your hand. Give Ai into your hand. So Joshua stretched out the javelin that was in his hand toward the city. The men in ambush rose quickly from their place, and when he had stretched out his hand, they ran and entered the city and captured it. And they quickly set the city on fire. That fire, of course, kept the Ai soldiers who had left the city to chase the soldiers of Israel who were deceiving them by retreating. They're in the valley. They turn around. The city's on fire. Now they can't get back in. So they are in deep doo-doo. Verse 18 says, the Lord said to Joshua. That is repeated so many times. God said to Moses. God said to Joshua. That the commentators never mention it anymore. But whenever I read that, I always think, well, how? Was it an audible voice? He's sitting there. Joshua's standing there in the valley trying to time all this military strategy, and God speaks to him. How does he do it? An internal impression or audible voice? It obviously wasn't a dream because it's in the middle of the daytime. So I think that if I lived to 200 years, I might like to research that issue. Maybe somebody writes a theological paper on it somewhere. I haven't found it yet. Now, Joshua raised a javelin in verse 18. Some think there was a flag attached to that javelin to make it easier to see by the ambushers. And, of course, they would have been acquainted with such a flag and also the signal of the javelin before they left into the ambush. That goes without saying. And this not only was a sign for the ambushers to start ambushing Ai to come into the city of Ai, it was also a sign to Israel to turn around and face their pursuers and stop their fake retreat. Now, the ambushers quickly set the city on fire, as verse 19 says. Now, there's a problem here. If the city was burnt completely down by that fire, the Israelites had not taken it yet. The main army had not taken it yet. So how could the city be plundered for spoil? At one time I thought, well, that's easy to answer. You just assume the fire would be set after the plunder was taken. But that doesn't work because, as we'll see in verses 20 through 23, when the fire was set, the men of Ai were in the valley. They turned around. They looked back from their pursuit of the Israelites, and their city was smoking and burning up. And then in verse 21, Joshua turned back and beat the men of Ai. So they hadn't had a chance to get plunder yet. So John Gill, Adam Clark, and Jameson Fawcett and Brown, out of the mouth of three witnesses, shall the truth be established. They said this fire was not to burn the city down, but only some outlying houses were burnt down to let the men of Ai know that they could not go back in and they were trapped. And I think that makes a lot of sense. We go down to Joshua chapter 8, verses 20 through 23. The men of Ai turned and looked back, and smoke from the city was rising to the sky. They could not escape in any direction, and the troops who had fled to the wilderness now became the pursuers. That's the 30,000 Israeli troops who had executed a feint and had retreated into the wilderness, probably the wilderness of Bethaven. And now they turned around and started chasing the soldiers of Ai back toward their city, which was burning on the outskirts. When Joshua and all Israel saw that the men in ambush had captured the city and that smoke was rising from it, they turned back and struck down the men of Ai. Then men in ambush came out of the city against them, and the men of Ai were trapped between the Israelite forces, some on one side and some on the other. So the 5,000 that were in the city came out of the city and got the soldiers of Ai from the south, and the 25,000 troops from the north came down from the north and squeezed them, sandwiched them in. They were trapped. The Israelites struck them down until no survivor or fugitive remained, but they captured the king of Ai alive and brought him to Joshua. Now, in verse 20, it says the men of Ai turned and looked back to see that smoke of their burning city. What made them turn and look back? Probably because the retreating Israeli army had turned around and looked at the smoke. They had seen the javelin. One of their scouts had seen the javelin. They turned around, and then the smoke went up, and sooner or later, the men of Ai are going to see. Even if none of that had happened, one of their soldiers could have said, hey, just happened to look back, and the city's burning, and so the word would spread. But more probably, Joshua raised a spear when the fire from the ambush had started. He raised a spear. The ambushers came in, set the fire, and then sooner or later, somewhere in that process, the soldiers of Ai realized, oh my gosh, our city is burning. They must have been in total panic after seeing they were ambushed, and that must have made it very difficult to fight. Not to mention the fact they were bodaciously outnumbered. There was no survivor left, except, of course, the king, who was hung later. He was brought alive to Joshua. Joshua's still in the valley, probably watching all this. And the king of Ai is brought alive to Ai, probably to give him a more shameful death, as John Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say. We go now to Joshua 8, verses 24 through 27. Now when Israel had finished killing all the inhabitants of Ai in the field in the wilderness where they pursued them, and all of them were fallen by the edge of the sword until they were destroyed, then all Israel returned to Ai and struck it with the edge of the sword. All who fell that day, both men and women, were 12,000, all the people of Ai. For Joshua did not withdraw his hand with which he stretched out the javelin till he had utterly destroyed all the inhabitants of Ai. Israel took only the cattle and the spoil of that city as plunder for themselves, according to the word of the Lord which he had commanded Joshua. So in verse 24, all the inhabitants of Ai in the field, that means the army, the 6,000 or so men of Ai who had pursued the fainting Israelites, they got killed in the fields outside of Ai. Wiped them out. And then Israel left the fields of Ai and went back to the city itself, and then they struck Ai with the edge of the sword by killing the men and women who were in there, and the old people, and the children. And when you add all that up, the soldiers and the people in the city was 12,000. Verse 25. Verse 26, Joshua did not withdraw his hand with which he stretched out the javelin. Doesn't that not remind you of Moses at Rephidim right before Sinai, when the Amalekites attacked Israel, and Aaron and Hur held up Moses' arm so that he could hold up his staff. And when Moses held his staff up, Joshua, this same Joshua here, would fight the Amalekites. And then when Moses' hand came down from being tired, Joshua would start losing to the Amalekites. And so this idea of stretching out a javelin, the idea is the prophet of God or the representative of God is taking authority over the situation here. I love the parallels between Moses and Joshua. Why ask him to hold up the javelin so long? I don't know which of my commentators said this because I forgot to write it down, but let me read it. Quote, perhaps from the long continuance of the posture, i.e. of holding up the javelin, it might have been a means appointed by God to animate the people and kept up in the same devout spirit as Moses had shown in lifting up his hands until the work of slaughter had been completed and the band executed. In other words, it's just kind of dramatic to see your leader up there with that javelin held up in the air. Keep at it, boys. The word only is used here again in verse 27. Israel took only the cattle and the spoil of the city. In other words, they couldn't take the men or the women or the children as slaves. We go now to Joshua 8, verses 28 and 29, and we'll finish this chapter. So Joshua burned Ai and made it a heap forever, a desolation until this day. He hanged the king of Ai on a tree until evening, and at sunset Joshua gave command, and they took his body down from the tree and threw it at the entrance of the city gate and raised over it a great heap of stones that stands to this day. Now in verse 28, when it says Joshua burned Ai, this is the whole city, not just the outskirts, that were used as a barrier to keep the troops of Ai who had left the city to chase the Israelites from returning back into the city. This is burning it down to make it an ash heap. Made it a heap forever. Of course, that's a long time. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, it's not forever, world without end, eternity. Olam, I think the word is. You'll find that word is misused a lot in theological discourse. Ai, in fact, was rebuilt. It was inhabited by the Jews upon return from Babylon in 538 or 537, whenever it was, B.C. 537, I think it was. Nehemiah 11:31. Nehemiah, of course, is an exilic prophet, actually a post-exilic prophet, I really should say. The sons of Benjamin also lived from Geba onward at Michmash and Aijah, which is just another word for Ai. Michmash, if you might recall, was where in the previous chapter the Israelites had retreated from the gates of the city down to Michmash. So this is the same area. All right, so we have here Nehemiah talking about the returning exiles lived at Ai, so it was rebuilt. So that forever does not mean forever, world without end. It just means for a long time. If Joshua entered into the land in 1406 B.C., traditional date, and the return from Babylon was in 537 or so now we're talking about, what, 850 years or so? So it was a long time. If that was indeed the first time the city had been rebuilt upon the return from Babylon. Don't know. But Babylon remained a desolation until this day. Now, Ezra was writing at the time, in fact, before Nehemiah. So when Ezra was writing, Ai was not a desolation, as I just read, Nehemiah 11:31. So that means Ezra couldn't have been writing this book. Very well could have been Joshua. This is an argument for Joshua writing this. Again, I'm not going to get into that argument. That technical kind of stuff just doesn't really bother me too much one way or the other. Verse 29, Joshua hanged the king of Ai on a tree. Adam Clark says probably the king had already been killed by other means, perhaps by strangling. It was not customary in those times to burn men alive. They did it in the Middle Ages and when the crime was extraordinary. For example, witchcraft, things like that. Well, the king was really mad at you for treason, and that was the worst way. And, of course, the execution was to try to stop the agony. Bloody Mary did it to a lot of Protestants. The way to stop the agony was to put a pouch of gunpowder and tie it around the neck of the victim so that the fire would hit the gunpowder and blow them up before they had to experience all the excruciating pain of being burnt alive. Well, fortunately, the king of AI didn't live in the Middle Ages. He was just hanged. Perhaps strangled first, we don't know. At sunset, Joshua said, "Take him down from the tree." Why was he put on the tree to start with? Well, it was to terrorize other Canaanite kings. They, like in the Middle Ages, in England, they would always take the heads of traitors and put them up on post on London Bridge and leave them there for years so that every time you cross the bridge, you could see that ghoulish skull staring down at you. But here, it was to terrorize other Canaanite kings. Perhaps they would submit without a battle, saving a lot of life, both Canaanite and Israelite. So he was hung on a tree, but he could only stay there for one day because the law in Deuteronomy 21:23 says that a carcass hanging after sunset would defile the land. Deuteronomy 21:23, "His corpse shall not hang all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day, for he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance." Verse 29, "The corpse was thrown in front of the gates of the city," or the gate of the city. Why? Same reason he was hung up on a tree, is to terrorize anybody who passed that way. We don't mess with these Israelites. And to make the position of the body more well known, Joshua raised over the body a great heap of stones. Now that heap of stones is a method of marking a grave, and it was very common at that time to mark graves with piles of stones. Ladies and gentlemen, I have finished with Joshua chapter 8, verses 1 through 29, and Ai has fallen. Before we go on any further with the conquest of Canaan, we need to see Joshua renewing the covenant at this happy interlude, at this happy time after the defeat of Ai. So we will see that in Joshua 8, verses 30 through 35. It's going to be a short one. Hope you stay tuned for that one. Hope you enjoyed this one.